Meanwhile, the Italian government said earlier this week it could hold another humanitarian ship for 2 weeks to conduct an investigation after it was allowed to land with 80 migrants. The Open Arms pulled into the Italian port of Lampedusa on Tuesday night, following a three-week standoff during which the Italian government refused to safe harbor. A Spanish Navy frigate will now escort the Open Arms boat back from Italy with a token number of 10 refugees Spain has agreed to take in. It could be the Barcelona-based ship's last voyage under mounting pressure to stop rescuing shipwrecked African migrants. We have more international headlines for you on voanews.com. Go there for the latest. I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
charity officials say the migrants are increasingly concerned about what will happen to them and fearful they may be returned to Libya.
That's reporter Sabina Castelfranco on the latest standoff over a migrant ship that has been stranded at sea for nearly 2 weeks. Details coming up also. This month marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in the U.S. state of Virginia. And saying the animals are suffering a silent extinction, the Global Wildlife Convention has adopted a proposal to protect giraffes in Africa. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this August marks the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in Virginia, a state on the eastern coast of the United States. Their arrival was the start of what would become one of the darkest chapters in U.S. history, 224 years of slavery. VOA's Chris Simpkins documented the events where history was made and reported on how these African slaves, along with the many who followed and their descendants, shaped the course of a nation. He spoke with Steve Miller.
So, Chris, I really wanted to talk about this project and specifically your experiences with it. You did a number of interviews and you met several people along the way. What really stood out to you and about their stories?
It was an eye-opening experience for me because I'm an African-American growing up in the South in the 1970s. Never read or saw a lot about this history. There was very much little in terms of the history of slavery in our textbooks. And when we did see passages about slavery, it was always from the standpoint that the enslaved people from Africa came to colonial America with little or no skills, and they learned everything once they reached the new world, so to speak. But in my reporting, I found out that that was simply not the case, that the arrival of the first enslaved Africans, they all came here with skills, agricultural skills, political skills. They were baptized. They had their own names, which were eventually taken from them. So that was amazing in and of itself. Also, I didn't know about the arrival of the first enslaved Africans who came to what is now Hampton, Virginia in 1619, the latter part of August, and where their lives began and where they ended up was all new to me and very fascinating in terms of reporting.
Can you share a little bit about that? I mean, as they arrived here, they were enslaved and taken elsewhere. Where do their families, you know, descend from now?
Well, we see a lot in the same, very same area that they arrived in, the Hampton Roads, Virginia area, the Norfolk, Hampton, Virginia Beach areas of Virginia. Virginia. And what I learned was that these first enslaved people came over. They were not actually slaves at that time, because the colony of Virginia had not codified slavery until 1661.
So what did they come over as then?
They came over basically as what we know as indentured servants. They worked alongside white indentured servants who were under contract, who came primarily from England, and they had no status at that time, Steve. So they were held against their will, but it wasn't until laws that were later passed in Virginia that officially said that they would be slaves. Anyone born to any children born from them would be slaves for life. Basically, the hardship and humiliation of slavery did not end with the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery in 1865, and that African Americans continued to endure racist violence, entrenched poverty, and inequities in areas such as education, employment, and the criminal justice system. And I found out these are legacies today that we in this country have to deal with. That is a direct result of what began 400 years ago.
Chris Simpkins reports for VOA and his video series about the 1619 slave trade can be found on the VOAnews.com website. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure to be with you, Steve.
And that was VOA's Chris Simpkins talking with Steve Miller. Today, VOA and Norfolk State University will hold an international town hall to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the first Africans landing in North America. The event is being televised live from 1630 to 1730 UTC. You can watch the event at voanews.com and youtube.com/voaaudio. A day after the presidents of Uganda and Rwanda signed an agreement to lower tensions that led to a six-month border closure, political and economic analysts are casting doubt on what will follow. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala that observers say underlying trade issues have not been addressed.
The agreement signed Wednesday by Uganda President Yoweri Museveni and Rwanda President Paul Kagame is being only hesitantly welcomed in both countries. In the pact, the two leaders agreed to respect each other's sovereignty and avoid action that could destabilize either country. But analysts say the deal does not address underlying issues that led to the closure of the border. In late February, Rwanda closed the border at the Gatuna-Katuna crossings in the Kisoro district. Since then, Rwanda citizens reportedly were advised not to enter Uganda, and business came to a standstill, with Ugandan traders denied entry into Rwanda. Kiza Africa, an economic analyst with the regional trade body Siatini, the Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, recorded complaints from 6,000 traders, 70% of whom were women, during the border closure. He says even though the agreement indicates the two countries will open the border, including movement of persons and goods, the traders will not withdraw their legal case.
The East African Court of Justice should pronounce itself that no such a thing should ever happen again in the region. Another, which is the core of the case, compensations for the affected parties, who are the cross-border women, the informal traders. That has not been done.
Since the border closure, Uganda's Ministry of Trade recorded an inter-trade loss with Rwanda of $920 million by the end of July. Since March, the two countries have traded accusations of kidnappings, detentions, killings, and spying. Rwanda publicly accused Uganda of abducting its citizens and supporting rebels who want to overthrow President Kagame. President Museveni, in a letter published in the Ugandan government newspaper, admitted meeting some of the anti-Kagame forces, but said he does not support the idea of an overthrow. In an effort to implement the UN Luanda resolutions intended to stabilize the region, the leaders agreed to establish an ad hoc commission that is headed by the ministers of foreign affairs and includes the ministers of internal affairs and heads of intelligence. Political analyst Dr. Tolit Atia thinks the ad hoc commission will not resolve any issue because political issues continue to directly affect citizens of both countries.
In as long as the citizens continue to mobilize against good governance or what they see as oppressive governance, this shall continue to play alongside each other's border. And the principals need to look straight into the matter and begin to discuss probably what they are avoiding most. And those are the issues of governance.
Both analysts also questioned why the agreement was signed in Angola and not within the East African region. That's where both countries are members of the East African community, led by President Kagame, who is the current chairman. Kiza says there is a need for political change because of the constant differences between top political leaders.
You start seeing a lot of protectionism, a lot of inward looking from the other partner states. And we can only do that by putting aside political differences and looking at economic gains, but also by strengthening the dispute settlement body.
It remains to be seen whether the signing of this pact will see a final conclusion to the ever-growing political tension between the two countries. Athmani Halima for VOA News, Kampala.
The Global Wildlife Convention sites has adopted a proposal by five African countries to protect giraffes for the first time, saying the animals are suffering a silent extinction. The species will be listed on CITES Appendix 2, which will regulate international trade in giraffe parts, such as hides, bones, and meat. The proposal for protecting giraffes was proposed by the governments of Central African Republic, Chad, Kenya, Mali, Niger, and Senegal, with support from other countries in the African Elephant Coalition. In what risks becoming the latest migrant standoff with Italy, the Norwegian-flagged Ocean Viking has been stranded at sea awaiting port access for nearly 2 weeks. It's carrying 356 migrants, including more than 100 minors, mainly from Sudan. Malta has already denied it access, and two requests made to Italy by the two French charities running the ship have not received a response. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
After 13 days at sea, the plight of the migrants on board the NGO rescue ship Ocean Viking remains unclear. France has said it is prepared to take 40 of the 356 migrants. Charity officials say the migrants are increasingly concerned about what will happen to them and fearful they may be returned to Libya. But Paris also has said the principle of sailing to the nearest port is solid. Malta already has denied access to its port and Italy has not responded to the requests made by the NGO ship. Italy, which at present is focused on resolving a political crisis, has been taking a hard line with its closed ports policy implemented by far-right Interior Minister Matteo Salvini. The Ocean Viking is a Norwegian-flagged vessel run by two French charities, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, and SOS Méditerranée. The migrants on board were rescued in four different missions off the coast of Libya. They include about 90 unaccompanied minors. Charity workers on board say the supplies are running low and the crew has decided to ration showers to save water. Luca Pigozzi, one of the doctors on board the Ocean Viking, says the migrants already are traumatized and have been through much suffering. Pigozzi said the most serious emergency at the moment is the psychological emergency. These people are suffering from very severe psychological traumas. Many have been tortured or sexually abused. Pigozzi added that this waiting in the confined space of the ship can only worsen their psychological conditions. Doctors Without Borders project coordinator Jay Berger said a rescue ship is like an ambulance where people should be transported, not living on it. He called the situation shameful and inhumane. Berger added that leaving migrants on boats for weeks until the crisis becomes an emergency is becoming the new norm. He says it is taking too long for a solution to be found. Talks are underway to find other European nations prepared to accept migrants, although none other than France have come forward for the time being. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
19 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Kenya has intensified its bid to secure a non-permanent seat at the UN Security Council to represent the African continent. Ambassador Boaz Mbai is a career diplomat with over 30 years' experience in international relations and author of a new book titled Kenya's Foreign Policy and Diplomacy. VOA's reporter Ruben Chama asked him about Kenya's interest in the Security Council seat.
It is significant because that is the decision-making body of the United Nations system. It is the executive body of the United Nations system where decisions once taken are binding to all member states. So it is important to be aware that decision-making takes place. Kenya is representing the Eastern African countries, seeking a seat that represents the Eastern African countries, and it goes by rotation. So this time it is between Kenya and Djibouti to sort out who is likely to be. We think Kenya has the best chance, because one, we have the capacity to deal with it. We've been on the council in 1997-98, and we know what it takes. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. It takes many diplomats, and it takes a lot of resources. We think we can mount that and do a good job for this sub-region.
You are also involved in the push towards reforming the UN system. Could you share with us some of your experiences? What actually made that important?
The reform of the UN started as soon as it was formed in 1945, I think, if I can remember very well. Kenya has had an opportunity to express itself within the OAU then, and the African Union now, and also on its own as a country. We think the reform is necessary because it is skewed towards the developed countries. You find United States, UK, France, and then Russia and China as the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. The geographical spread is not there, and we think Africa deserves a chance. Africa deserves a seat on the council because, one, the majority of the issues discussed at the council are affecting African continent, conflicts, destability, insecurity, and so forth. So we need to be there to try and explain what exactly is happening in this continent.
What are some of the emerging issues within the UN system?
I'm not sure whether they're emerging because I think the issues have been there for some time. Terrorism, for instance, drug trafficking, human trafficking, those are no longer issues that are emerging. Democracy, accountability, transparency, those have been with us for nearly 30 years, 30, 40 years. They are issues which influence foreign policy of any country, whether it is a developed country or a developing country. If we can think together, both developed and developing countries, along the same lines of reading from the same page, the world will be much, much better.
What's the contribution of African countries to the global debate so far?
I think African countries provide a very good debate for the UN system. Number two, African countries provide problems which require solutions, and most of the solutions, whether they are economic, political, and security, have been based on experience that African countries are experiencing. So the contribution by Africa is quite immense, and that's why it is important for Africa to have actually a permanent seat on the UN Security Council.
Recently we have seen Kenya also trying to better relations between Kenya and the Caribbean. How are the relations, and what can Kenya benefit from trading with countries in the Caribbean?
I think it is important for Kenya to have a footprint in the Caribbean. One, we share history of British colonialism. Our founding fathers were fighting for independence together with leaders from the Caribbean countries. So we're sharing ideas, how we performed since independence. Number two, we are looking for economic cooperation. And economic cooperation in the Caribbean countries would emphasize South-South cooperation. South-South cooperation is very important in a globalized world like now. And I think Kenya needs to spread and have a footprint in every part of the globe for us to sustain ourselves. If you can remember in the 70s when UNEP and Habitat, the decision was taken to host those two bodies in Kenya, it was through South-South Cooperation that Kenya managed to get the two bodies hosted in Kenya. And they remain the only United Nations headquarters in the developing countries. So it is important.
That was Ambassador Boaz Mbai, a Kenyan career diplomat and an international relations expert. He spoke with VOA's Ruben Chama in Nairobi. Amidst international condemnation, Zimbabwe's recent clampdown on dissenting voices has worsened with the intended strike called for by the country's main opposition party, MDC Alliance. Adigando has more on recent developments.
On Monday, the High Court in Bulawayo upheld the police ban against the planned demonstrations by the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance. The city of Bulawayo was largely under heavy police watch. Shops were closed and the central business district was heavily cordoned off. Public commuter operators and pirate taxis reported being stopped from ferrying commuters into the city center by heavily armed police with water cannons and tankers. The Gertrude Mtombeni House, which is the MDC Alliance's provincial headquarters, was also sealed off by police, with opposition leaders not being allowed access to their own building. The planned August 19 demonstrations was cancelled after the police issued a prohibition order banning citizens from protesting. In another development, a section of the business community, including the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers Association and the Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe, had also lodged an application with the High Court to have the demonstrations permanently stayed. They feared the destruction of their property and looting from demonstrators. The MDC Alliance in turn filed an urgent application with the High Court to interdict the police from banning the demonstration. The High Court ruled against the opposition. In a press conference after the ruling, the MDC Alliance Secretary for Justice and Legal Affairs, Innocent Gonese, spoke on the developments.
We are witnessing something far worse than what we used to experience under Robert Mugabe. We notified the police in accordance with the provisions of the law. And everything that we've been doing is above board. And one would have expected the regulating authorities to try to protect the rights of the people of Zimbabwe. As you are all aware, the prohibition order in respect of Ulawayo was issued yesterday. We're very surprised because the magistrate acknowledged the rights which are enshrined in the Constitution, but we're very surprised by the conclusion.
The MDC Alliance says that rather than banning the protests outright, police should remain impartial and cooperate with MDC demonstration planners to ensure that law and order is maintained. The Constitution requires that the police merely are informed of demonstrations and that it is incumbent upon the police to ensure the demonstrations proceed peacefully. On his part, government maintains that the demonstrations will be violent because of an agitated citizenry and insists on banning the demonstrations in a bid the police says is meant to enforce law and order.
What we find very surprising is that they will tell us that they don't have enough manpower, for example, when they respond to the notices. But surprise, surprise, when it comes to the general question, we then find them armed to the teeth and descending upon all the cities where they give the notification that we intend to demonstrate.
Political observers, however, say the government is violating legitimate constitutional rights to demonstrate, freedom of expression and association. They say that with the banning of the demonstrations, the political space is being constricted in driving disgruntled citizens into a corner, where the options for a legal route dwindling. Observers say the opposition MDC Alliance is facing tough odds.
But obviously, as a party, we've got a leadership. We are going to sit down and review the situation in regard to the course of action we are going to take in the event that these prohibitions are issued willy-nilly without regard to the actual provisions of the law.
The planned demonstrations for Gweru, Mashingo and Mutare have been banned by the police, setting the stage for the opposition to weigh their options. Meanwhile, MDC Alliance National Chairperson Tabitha Kumalo, who had been arrested along with five others while doing a door-to-door campaign in support of the Blawaya demonstration, was released yesterday on $200 bail. The state media reports that 91 people have been arrested in and around the country for their links to the planned demonstration. Unofficial reports compiled by the opposition's social welfare department put the figure at 106 persons arrested.